Welcome to another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z. So glad you could join us today for this fabulous program where we talk about health, wellness, and issues in alternative medicine today, which I guess is no longer becoming alternative as we speak. That's our mission, to kind of embed it in the consciousness of everybody out there. And so remember, you can always get more information about our walks and talks and fun shops and events and things like that at naturalnurse.com or drzdrznaturally.com. So we're really excited to have on our highly respected and sought after cardiologist with an integrative approach, Dr. Steven Sinatra. He's a fellow of the American College of Cardiology and College of Nutrition and a nutrition specialist, CNS, and bioenergetic psychotherapist, which we're going to be talking about the effect of the mind and on the heart and other things that we do. He's an author, speaker, and advisor for research, and he's the author of more than a dozen books, including one of my favorite, The Great Cholesterol Myth, Reversing Heart Disease Now, CoQ10 Phenomenon, Heart Sense for Women. And it is, important to talk about all these things, the Sinatra Solution, metabolic cardiology. He's published, he's been on many, many programs, including our program. I know his son is a naturopathic physician, so we had that conversation last time he was on, and he actually hails from Connecticut, where I live and practice now, and he did all kinds of work there as chief of cardiology, echocardiogram, cardiac rehab, and weight reduction program. So today we're going to be talking about, habits that are terrible for your heart. So welcome, Dr. Sinatra. Great to have you on again.
Gee, Dr. Z, thank you. Thanks for such a nice intro. That was really sweet.
Yeah, very welcome. Yeah. So let's talk about, your heart as a not only an organ, the most metabolically active organ in our body, I think, but also as a spiritual kind of entity. Because, in Chinese medicine, the heart is where the hun is. The hun is like the spirit, not the spirit that survives death, but your spirit and your dreams, emotions. All those things are registered in this interesting organ there. So how do we separate the organ from the spiritual aspects of the heart? It's interesting. You've worked on both aspects of it, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. I mean, a lot of people think that the brain rules the body, but really it's the heart. And, the heart has a special voice. And it actually, there's a connection between the heart and the brain via the vagus nerve. So basically the emotions of the heart can affect the brain, and certainly the emotions of the brain can affect the heart. So it's sort of like a two-way circuit. But I'll tell you, as a heart specialist and as a psychotherapist, the heart rules. It really does. In other words, if I had to choose between which organ was more pervasive, it's certainly the heart, because a lot of people wear their heart on their sleeve, so to speak. In other words, their emotionality comes out. And especially during this pandemic, where we're seeing a lot of depression, a lot of panic, a lot of disconnection. And a lot of that disconnection occurs on the heart level, where people don't feel close, where they feel socially isolated. And we need to take care of our heart, because the heart is the most vulnerable organ, much more vulnerable than the brain. Yeah. So, the heart and the brain share similar pathways, but the vulnerability is much more pervasive in the heart than the brain.
Isn't there a way to balance the EKG with the EEG? Talk a little bit about that. I know that's kind of like a whole discipline of trying to get those two things in sync.
Well, what you're talking about is the heart and the brain are electrical organs. I mean, that's what you're talking about. Yeah. We can monitor the brain through the EEG and get, different wavelengths and look at the brain from the activity of the EEG. The heart records the EKG. In other words, we put electrodes on a chest and we get an electrical movement. And then there's always a lie detector test, which I think is kind of cool, where when we were doing our research on earthing and grounding, we realized how the lie detector test was absolutely amazing, because when you tell a lie and you're not a sociopath, for example, you're a regular human being, you know, you don't have these attributes where you can cheat a lie detector test, and 99.9% of people can't. But when you tell a lie, there's a blip, and basically it has to do with the autonomic nervous system. So, you know, if the autonomic nervous system doesn't realize the truth, and the truth is really found in the heart. So, you know, there's so much message going on, so much conversation going on between the heart and the brain that I'll tell you, it's very, very complex. And as a heart specialist, I'm just amazed about the complexity of the heart. And remember this, the heart, when we look at an organ compared to the brain, compared to the kidney, compared to, you know, the liver, et cetera, the heart has the most mitochondria. These are the energy producing factories in the cells. So the heart has the most mitochondria than any organ. So the heart has a special architecture. And basically, you know, the voice of the heart, I think, is really the ruler of the body.
Well, that's well said. So interesting. And there's a lot of things, I guess, that we can do that bother the heart. Let's go back to some of the more kind of basic concepts that I think cardiologists, you know, your kind of allopathic colleagues are kind of locked into this paradigm, which is based on probably a lot of lies and falsehoods and things like that. It's kind of interesting that they're kind of locked in this, you know, whatever dimension, but or flat, what I call flat earth medicine, you know, like when everyone thought the world was flat, and then of course, you know, we figured that out, that wasn't true. But nonetheless, so they're kind of locked in this paradigm of thinking that like cholesterol is bad. I know you wrote the cholesterol myth. And eventually, you know, we'll get into the more interesting stuff about the heart. Not that that's not interesting, but things like going to bed after midnight, walking around barefoot, being, you know, all these different habits that bother the heart, and the that interesting connection between the Shen or the spirit. So, but let's talk about what most the American Heart Association says, like we should all be on statins. We should all be on, we have a statin deficiency, you know, like when you get a headache, you have an aspirin deficiency. I'm sure you've heard that before.
Oh, gosh. Yes, many, many times, Dr. Z. You see, one of the reasons why I wrote The Great Cholesterol Myth was that, you know, everybody thinks, you know, you watch TV, you see these commercials, that everybody thinks cholesterol is the cause of heart disease. And maybe about 5% of that is true, but 95% is not true. People don't realize that when it comes to the endothelium, of blood vessels, you know, that inner layer of the blood vessels that feed the heart, you know, the coronary vasculature, so to speak, that is very susceptible to what we call endothelial cell disruption or endothelial cell inflammation. And the prime hormone of that is insulin. In other words, insulin is really the major hormone that provokes, that antagonizes the vasculature of our body. And the problem is we need insulin to live, but too much insulin or surges up and down of insulin can be disastrous to the body. And insulin is a very pro-inflammatory hormone. Now, what provokes insulin? Well, it's sugar. So basically, the paradigm should be too much sugar is bad for the heart, not too much cholesterol. People think that, oh, my God, I got to get my cholesterol down. People don't realize you need cholesterol for brain function. I mean, one of the side effects of statins is that people lose their memory, or people develop early Alzheimer's disease, or people can't remember where they put their car keys and stuff like that. Well, the reason for that is you need cholesterol for the brain to talk, for the brain's neurons to talk to one another. And when the cholesterol gets too low, the neurons sort of, you know, sputter, so to speak. It's very, very unfortunate, but basically cholesterol is needed by the body, And, you know, the brain is one organ, but the GI tract, you know, we need cholesterol to prevent infections. I mean, my gosh, I mean, MRSA in children, for example, is a frightful illness where if you get methicillin-resistant staph, you can die. And children with the highest cholesterol do the best. In other words, they can thwart off MRSA staph. And so, I mean, cholesterol...
How did the myth happen? Dr. Sinatra, was it like based on some studies? I remember in naturopathic school, Michael Murray teaching us nutrition, and he talked about Framingham study or some other studies that they started building this whole edifice of this house of cards on cholesterol myth.
Well, the house of cards actually started with Ansel Keys. This was in the early 1950s.
Where
he demonstrated, but he sort of cherry picked his data, which is not a good thing when it comes to, you know, scientific analysis. But basically, he demonstrated that a lot of the Western countries like Australia, Great Britain, and the USA had high cholesterols, and they had a lot of heart disease as well. But, you know, look at France, for example. The average cholesterol in France is higher than the average cholesterol in the United States. I mean, the average cholesterol in France is like 275, but they have the lowest incidence of heart disease in Western Europe. So, you know, a lot of his theories seem to fall apart. And unfortunately, a lot of his hypotheses were considered dogma, and it came out of Harvard and all those other institutions. And it took several years to break the myth, so to speak. And when real science is brought to the table, you know, we do realize that, you know, certain cholesterol patterns can be inflammatory, like LP little a, for example. I mean, LP little a is really the truth about cholesterol, but it's usually inherited. And we determined that with the Biogenome Project, you know, when we deciphered the DNA back in the mid-1990s, when those three guys won the Nobel Prize. But basically, when it comes to cholesterol, we need cholesterol, like I mentioned. You know, we need it in the GI tract. We need it in the brain. We need it to fight off infections. And I got to tell you, even in this COVID-19 pandemic, I mean, you know, somebody will probably write this paper, but, you know, we might determine that, you know, cholesterol could be a favorable situation. I don't know yet the answer to that. But I do know, for example, that whenever you can prevent endothelial cell dysfunction, like, you know, using coenzyme Q10 or using omega-3s or even melatonin for that matter, you know, a lot of these natural nutraceuticals, you know, can be combative, you know, especially with viruses and bacterial infections as well.
And the polyphenols that we get in our diet and in spices, you know, it's interesting. I was doing some research on the highest polyphenol foods, and I found that it's the spices like cinnamon and cloves, which even are way higher in their antioxidant power than even green tea and things like that, which of course is great too. But I was interested in your take on how antioxidants and oxidative LDL, is that one of the villains, or is it's that whole pro-inflammatory oxidative process that we're trying to mitigate?
Yeah, you bring up a good point, Dr. Z. I mean, when cholesterol becomes oxidized, it becomes angry, it becomes inflammatory. What oxidizes cholesterol? See, that's the key. Well, sugar is a big factor in that. In other words, a sugar relationship, and it has to do with, like I mentioned before, insulin. And, you know, certain foods, like you mentioned the polyphenols, very, very important, because polyphenols can prevent the inflammatory process or the oxidation of LDL. I'll tell you, I've always been enthralled by the Mediterranean basin. You know, if you look at the Mediterranean basin, whether you live in Greece or Spain, Portugal or Israel or Northern Africa, it doesn't matter. I mean, there's more 100-year-old plus people that live in a Mediterranean basin than the entire world. And you know, the Spaniards and the Portuguese just surpassed the Okinawans as having a lock on longevity. I mean, think about it, Dr. Z. The average American lives to 70. Well, we used to live to 79, but now we went back a year with COVID. Now we live to about 78, you know, point something. But the average Spaniard or the average person from Portugal lives to 87 and change, so to speak. Wow. So there's something different about, you know, we have great technology. We have, our hospitalization, scenarios are even far superior. But there's something about the Mediterranean basin. And you brought up the key word, inflammation. You see, there's something special about the Mediterranean basin. And if we look at it, I really think it's olive oil. There was an article in the journal called Genomics about a decade ago that blew me away. And basically, when the Biogenome Project was discovered, we realized that human beings, like you and I and everybody else on the planet, were born with pro-inflammatory genes. In other words, you know, we're dealt, you know, inflammation in our body. It's a congenital situation. But the miracle of olive oil, and you mentioned a key word, polyphenols. Remember, olive oil contains, you know, these really anti-inflammatory polyphenols. You know, we call them oleopurin, hydroxytyrosol. You know, they have these special names.
Right.
But in this journal article, it blew me away because what it said was that when you take in olive oil, what you're doing is you're taking pro-inflammatory genes, which ages you, but you're turning them back to a non-inflammatory state. In other words, you're reversing inflammation in the body. And every doctor on the planet knows that inflammation is the root cause of disease. In other words, whether you get Alzheimer's disease, heart disease, or cancer, it's all about inflammation. So if you can stop inflammation, thwart it, block it, at any level, the biochemical level, well, then you're doing, you know, really good things for the body. So when that PREDIMED study came out, you know, 6, 7, 8 years ago, one of the architects of the study, Dr. Gonzalez, I actually invited him to speak at the American College of Nutrition. You know, when they reported this study and they showed that people who took in like 4 tablespoons of olive oil a day, well, they drank it, they had less heart disease, less cancer, you know, less neurodegenerative disease, less Alzheimer's, less everything than the standard American Heart Association diet. So it was amazing. It was an amazing takeaway about, you know, the wonders of, you know, good saturated or monounsaturated fats, like particularly like olive oil, and how it can help prevent illness, disease. And the key word is accelerated aging. In other words, olive oil. And that's why you have all these 100-year-old people in the Mediterranean basin. You know, it's just absolutely amazing. But I think olive oil is a secret sauce because of the polyphenol activity.
Yeah, we just had a guest on a couple of weeks ago, Dr. Fitzgerald, one of my colleagues, someone I trained actually as a naturopath, and she wrote a book on anti-aging, and she talked about how polyphenols, and I know she was talking with Dr. Bland about the same type of thing, how they kind of silence genes and they, you know, they kind of block some of the expression of some of these genes, and they could be helpful for aging and cancer and repairing your DNA. I mean, it's really... Well, we're on the verge of so many interesting in our field of, you know, complementary and alternative medicine. So, but what about habits, you know, moving away from, you know, the cholesterol myth and things like that. So, of course, eating olive oil, great habit to do. I do it all the time with that, although I don't cook with it. You know, I cook
grapeseed
oil and things like that. We learned that in school and to store your oils in the fridge. You know, it's interesting. You walk around the regular grocery store, unless you go to a really fine health food store, I never see any of the oil stored in the fridge. That's where I remember my teacher saying, with Dr. Bill Mitchell, the late Dr. Bill Mitchell, great naturopathic mind, passed away maybe, you know, 15 years ago or so, but he used to say, store your oils and store your nuts and seeds and everything in the fridge. You need like 2 fridges to store all this oil, But most of the oil you find is like this palm oil and these other oils out there, corn oil that people are using to fry up whatever. So that I think that you're right. That's not a typical habit that we see in the United States, you know?
Yeah, well,
that is a habit we see. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, olive oil is very sensitive to light and heat, as you mentioned. And that's why when you ever purchase olive oil, you should get it in very dark bottles, because the darker the bottle, in other words, that helps preserve the polyphenol activity. Unfortunately, some of the bottles that you mentioned that you see it on the shelves, they're in a clear bottle so you can see the oil in it.
Yeah.
You don't want to buy that bottle. In other words, you want to buy the bottles that are very dark where you can't see the oil, because right. then it's protected from the ravages of light, which can really, you know, change the configuration over time. You know, it might take months, but it can change really the configuration. So it's important to know that.
Now, what about, I know you talk a lot about habits that are good for your heart. And one of the things you wanted to talk about is going to bed after midnight. I know if you know, you listen to the rhythms of the earth, and if you study Ayurvedic medicine and Chinese medicine, you realize that going to bed early keeps you healthy, wealthy, and wise. I even think there's an old aphorism with that saying that Ben Franklin talked about even. But you say it's actually can cause heart disease.
Yeah, there was a couple of studies that came out within the last year that really blew me away. One of them was on congestive heart failure. It came out about a year ago, and it demonstrated that people with congestive heart failure who went to bed after midnight didn't do well, as opposed to the people that went to bed earlier than midnight, or between 10 and 11. And a similar article only came out a couple of months ago in the European Heart Journal that looked at heart disease, heart attack, longevity, et cetera. And this was a big study. This was involving like almost 88,000 people. It was over a 5-year period. And what they did is that they put these monitors on people for about a week, and it measured their biorhythms, so to speak. And basically what it showed was that people who, if they went to bed after midnight, they had more cardiac situations, you know, more heart attack, more sudden death, more arrhythmias, as opposed to those who went to bed between 10 and 11. Now, between 10 and 11 was the sweet spot. If you went to bed before 10, you had more risk. If you went to bed after 11, you had the greatest risk. But if you went to bed between 10 and 11, you were in the sweet spot of the, what we call the circadian rhythms. In other words, you mentioned it. It was a natural chi of the body, so to speak. You know, the natural biohormonal rhythms of the body. And when these rhythms are set, you get less cortisol involvement, less adrenaline. And basically, this sweet spot between 10 and 11 protected these people the most. And like I said before, you know, when you have a study of 88,000 people, I mean, that's a good number to work with. So, you know, it's in the European Heart Journal. It came out in November 2021. I mean, anybody can read it. But I think, you know, when I saw that data, it moved me, so to speak, Dr. Z. And, you know, I said to myself, geez, I better start going to bed between 10 and 11 because at my age, my wife
goes to bed. She's like clockwork, 10 o'clock. And then I, you know, watch the news or something like that, which is not probably a good thing to do before you go to bed. So, you know, sometimes
I'll tell you, for women, I'm glad you mentioned that, because in this study, women were at much greater risk than men. So there's something about the women's physiology with the circadian rhythms that makes even more sense. So, yeah, when they teased the data out, it affected more women than men.
So fascinating. Did they hypothesize, like, why that was happening and what's so damaging to the heart based on just an hour or so? Is it really some hormones that's produced during that?
Yeah, in other words, what they hypothesized was that for having the best clock time, in other words, for our own intrinsic circadian rhythms to take over, was between 10 and 11. That was really the scientific, you know, sort of endpoint of the study, was that you got your body clock perfect between 10 and 11, so your hormones were regulated the best. They were haphazard after midnight or before 10 o'clock. So, you know, those people who went to bed at 9 o'clock were, you know, a little bit behind the eight ball, but past midnight, those were the worst disruptions of the natural body clock, which tends to protect you, you know, when you go to sleep between 10 and 11.
Any idea about waking up too? Is that was that sort of looked at, or they didn't look at that yet?
They didn't look at it, but there's other studies on that, and basically, you know, waking up. And the problem with today is, you know, a lot of people are waking up 3, 4, 5 times at night, and they go back to sleep.
Right.
But, if you can get 4 hours or more of restful sleep without waking up, that's really good. The other thing too is, the more dreaming you do at night, when we go into REM sleep, where we're really dreaming, and if you can recall some of these dreams. I think this is also supportive for the natural physiology of the body as well.
I know they spend a lot of time looking at cortisol, which is a stress hormone.
Right.
And how it's kind of released sometime in the middle of the, well, it's supposed to start waking us up at like, you know, maybe 4 or 5 in the morning. It's like when I've sent patients for their cortisol, you know, you can kind of map it out. Unfortunately, they don't, when you do those cortisol times 4, they're not making you wake up in the middle of the night to check your cortisol at the night. So you kind of have to imagine what the slope looks like when you connect the dots of these different data points. But you can kind of hypothesize that people with sleep problems and insomnia have probably an elevated cortisol or an advanced cortisol somewhat in the middle of the night. They're waking up versus, you know, 4, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock when we're supposed to wake up. So any idea as to what we can do for helping that clock? I know there's all kinds of great products out there that supposedly help our bodies with stress, like ashwagandha is one of my favorites that I usually put people on to try to get their clock to behave. Phosphoserine is one of those phospholipids that supposedly helps with the clock. I've even used raufia, which is what Mahatma Gandhi used, because it blunts norepinephrine and epinephrine, which are kind of ignored in the studies. Everyone's always focused on cortisol, but remember, norepinephrine and epinephrine are really the fight, flight, freeze, or faint hormones.
You know, I like what you said about ashwagandha. I mean, that's sort of like the you know, stress, you know, where people are under stress, you know, ashwagandha may, you know, sequester that or sort of regulate that. Have you used ashwagandha at night in some of your patients to help sleep, or do you use it more in the daytime, or, you know?
They can take a dose at night, but it's a slow acting plant. You know, the studies on ashwagandha show it has to be used for months to kind of start working. So there's other things that you can use that are quick cortisol busters. My favorite is passion flower, which really, if you read the old eclectic books, you know, these were medical doctors at the turn of the last century that were extensively geniuses in herbs. But that's all they had back then. There was no really synthetic things besides mercury and calomel and other things that, you know, people use, bleaching, bloodletting, etc. So the eclectics kind of went towards the herbs, and they said that passion flower helps people with this monkey mind. You know, we talked about the connection between the mind and the heart. Well, Buddha said the mind is like a drunken monkey. It could be like all over the place, you know? So to kind of settle the mind down, I think that's one of the reasons why some people can't sleep, is their mind is still moving a million miles a minute. And so passion flower helps bring that down. And also, you know, and it's debatable. Is it the mind that's causing the cortisol to be like that? Or is it the cortisol being released by the adrenals that then allows your mind to be very, and remember, the mind is housed in the heart.
Right. You see, you know, it's very, very complex. And especially with all the electromagnetics in the environment, you know, the cordless phones in the homes, the computers, you know, I mean, all these things with EMF, it disrupts melatonin as well. So a lot of us have a melatonin insufficiency. And, you know, I looked at a couple of papers on melatonin. They came out in the last year. They're incredible. And it shows that, you know, melatonin may even be a useful adjuvant in COVID-19 because melatonin has enormous anti-inflammatory effects, you know, as well as being, you know, the sleep hormone, so to speak. So, you know, melatonin is another consideration to use, you know, especially maybe even during a pandemic. So instead of using the typical 1 milligram or 2 milligram doses, you know, consider doubling or tripling the dose. In other words, it may help us, you know, sleep a little longer. At the same time, we're supporting the immune system against, you know, viruses and bacteria.
That reminds me of one of my test questions on a recent exam. I said, what's the connection between melatonin and CoQ10? What nutrient helps synthesize the two of them? You know, I teach advanced biochemistry nutrition at the University of Bridgeport. And the answer is SAMI. S-adenomethionine, which is a particular type of methionine. SAMI actually helps you make CoQ10 through tyrosine, and then SAMI is the last step to go from serotonin to melatonin. So now a lot of people are low in the SAMI because they're not taking enough of their B vitamins, and then their homocysteine goes up. So it's very much connected in biochemistry. Of course, you'd appreciate that, having a, you know, your nutritional biochemistry degree and whatnot, besides the cardiology degree. But I don't think medicine, I think that they forgot their biochemistry lessons, that's for sure, a lot of times, because they don't make these connections, you know.
Yeah, they don't. And you know, you brought up a good relationship when it comes to UV light. In other words, when people go out into the sun, for example, and they go out unprotected. Like I live in Florida for most of the year, and I walk the beach grounded all the time, and you know, I'll wear a hat. But the two antioxidants that get sacrificed the quickest in the battle against UV light, harmful. In other words, a little UV light, like 15 minutes to a half hour, is vital. We get all our vitamin D, for example, mostly. I mean, people don't realize this, when the sunlight hits the skin, basically, the cholesterol in the skin, we're coming back to cholesterol now, but the cholesterol in the skin with the sunlight forms vitamin D3. And vitamin D3 is absolutely enormous, especially in this pandemic. I mean, a study just came out of Israel only a couple of days ago. You can check it out on in the PLOS, P-L-O-S journal. It only came out a few days ago. And what it showed was that Israelis who had a vitamin D level of like 40, which is a good level, as opposed to around 20, which is a bad level. But the higher the vitamin D level, they had 14 times the protection against COVID-19. I mean, think about that.
Oh, yeah.
So the vitamin D is very, very important. And the reason why I'm circling back is that after a half hour of UV light, now after a half hour, it's a little bit too much, where now you're going to get the breakdown you're going to get free radicals and the breakdown of collagen, et cetera, et cetera. But basically, the two antioxidants that protect you from UV light, and they used up within 30 minutes, you mentioned them, CoQ10 and melatonin. Those two antioxidants protect us the most against UV light, and you know, when we get too much of it. So basically, you know,
there's also this interesting study that I read about this. I guess they made a product out of it. It's called Fern Block. So they discovered this species of fern, Polypodium leucotoma. Got to Google this. And they've showed that if you take this fern, not only topically, but internally, it also protects you from the UV light. So we're back to the polyphenols again. So I think, you know, we need more of those things. You know, I always look at the plant world, Dr. Sinatra. Plants, they can sit out in the sun and photosynthesize and bake in that hot tropical sun. And they, you know, it's funny, they can get burned. I living up north, you know, I bring in a lot of my tropical plants in the wintertime, but if I put them out in May and don't acclimate them, they can get totally wiped out and burned. So, but they have this ability to bring up their own endogenous antioxidant level to the point where the leaves don't burn. We can't do that. We have to rely on outside sources of some antioxidants like the flavonoids, although we can make the melatonin and the CoQ10, which is kind of interesting, you know.
Right, so. Right. And the other thing I want to bring up, because it's important, you know, in the summertime, I'm sort of on the, I used to go to the Long Island beaches all the time. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget, I was at Montauk Point one year, and there were a bunch of kids. It was nice sunny. It was in September. And the moms were spraying the kids with these cans of, you know, like spray, which, you know, protects you against sunburn. And I was amazed because the moms unknowingly were spraying their kids, their whole body. But whenever you put a sunblock on, now you're blocking, you know, the good aspects of light as well. In other words, and there was a woman, I forget the name of her book, but I endorsed her book because she demonstrated that a lot of these sunscreens, you know, actually can cause skin cancer.
Really?
Yeah. So in other words, the best sunscreen to wear of all time is nitric oxide. Remember what the lifeguards used to wear on their nose? You know, this white material.
Zinc oxide.
Is so, the molecule is so big that it's not absorbed through the skin. That's why it's white. It stays white, but it blocks, you know, the UV light. In other words, but it's healthy because it's not absorbed through the skin. A lot of these sunscreens now that people put on are absorbed through the skin, and actually then it becomes sort of like a toxin to the body. So, you know, again, there's a sweet spot that we got to protect people. So, you know, overzealous use of sunblocks, you know, could be another evil going forward.
Now, you mentioned walking on the beach. I'm jealous, you know.
It's
cold up in Connecticut here. So, but wearing shoes all the time, you talked about too in some of your books and some of your amazing studies on what they call earthing, or I guess grounding, or whatever. I mean, that was kind of, do you know that there was an old naturopath, his name was Arnold Reakley, and there's a picture I have in my history lecture of him walking barefoot in the Bavarian Alps with some of his naturopathic students, and he's pointing to the sun. So he was a big believer in what they call heliotherapy, using the sun, and also walking barefoot. He thought that you could absorb the Earth's energy. Of course, they laughed at him, but now you actually have physical scientific documentation that's not so laughable. It really does help your body. Tell us about that.
Oh, it's amazing. You know, Dr. Z, I mean, I've been a physician now for, well, this May, in a few months, will be my 50th graduation from medical school. Right. I graduated Albany Med in 1972. So it'll be my 50th year. And, you know, if you look at it, as a third year medical student, as a fourth year medical student, you're even taking care of people at that time. I mean, you're doing a lot of doctoring, even as a student. But like the two greatest discoveries that I've ever made in my lifetime was really the utilization of CoQ10 and grounding. Now, what people don't realize is that CoQ10 and grounding share common ground. In other words, they are the best, and I mean the best electron donors around. In other words, you can get a lot of antioxidant potential by taking CoQ10 by mouth. I mean, it does a lot of good things for the body. It drives ATP in a preferential direction. It's the energy vitamin. It has a membrane stabilizing effect, and a sine qua non of aging is really the cellular membrane disrupts where toxins now get into the cell and where toxins can't get out and nutrients can't get in. But CoQ10 is an incredible membrane stabilizer. Now, grounding and CoQ10, like I said before, you can absorb antioxidants through the skin. Now, you're a naturopath and you probably studied a lot of Chinese medicine, but the K1 point is below the large toe. So when you walk barefoot, now you're walking on an acupuncture point where you're absorbing the Mother Earth energy. And basically that naturopath that was walking in Bavaria, for example, he knew that, even back then, because the Schumann resonance was discovered, years ago. And basically the Schumann resonance is this 7.83 hertz which is really comes from lightning strikes, that when lightning strikes the earth, you know, it empowers the earth with all these, you know, gazillions and gazillions of electrons. And this 7.83 hertz is like the ohm that the yogis say. It's like the humming of the earth, the bioelectric nature of the earth. And again, it comes from lightning strikes and, you know, sunstorms and stuff like that. And they travel, you know, millions of miles away. And the earth gets endowed in this electromagnetic, like, soup, so to speak. And whenever you touch Mother Earth with bare feet, you are now going to absorb this potential, this Schumann resonance. And this Schumann resonance does a lot of incredible things for the body. It's just amazing. And when Clint Ober introduced me to earthing and grounding about 18 years ago, and the research came out, all these papers, whether they were done in America or Western Europe, it didn't matter. Even Iran did a paper with COVID-19, you know, showing that, you know, grounded electrodes on the chest prevented blood clotting in the lung. In other words, it prevented the virus locking into the ACE receptor, causing enormous endothelial cell dysfunction. So, I mean, the essence of earthing and grounding is just, you know, unbelievable. It's just incredible, you know? So I have to say that my greatest discovery was really, you know, looking at the magic of Mother Earth. It's really amazing.
Now, if you walk on tile or rugs or wooden floors or versus just outside on the, I'm thinking about us guys in the wintertime.
Yeah, right.
Here in the Northeast, being that you're from the Northeast here, so you know how cold it can be.
So I would tell you this, Dr. Z, if you have a fireplace in your house and there's a hearth, you know, sit on it with your underwear and some bare skin, or put your hands on the stone, if it's stone or it's slate or if it's brick, you'll be grounded. If you have a basement floor and it's concrete, you know, well, you know, most of them are, without tile or wood, you'll be grounded. You know, so an old basement floor is good. Now, another secret is if your house is built, you know, by the 1970s or later, and if you run water through the faucet, and if you hold on to the faucet, you're grounded. In other words, running water through a steel faucet, so to speak, and if you hold on to it for a minute, you're grounded. Now, look, what we showed in our research is that it doesn't take long. In other words, even if you're grounded for a minute, you're having some phenomenal, you know, physiological and metabolic positive effects on the body. Now, I'll tell you this, Dr. Z. When I did this research over the last 10 years and published papers on it, as a heart specialist, you know, again, this is my greatest discovery, like CoQ10, because, I mean, to me, it was like, this is incredible healing stuff, and it's free. You know, in other words, you can get it from Mother Earth. But when I realized how important this was, I moved my house. In other words, I lived here in a house in Florida. And when these condominiums came available on the seashore, what I did was I sold my house and I put a deposit down on a ground floor. I have to say ground floor condominium. I called Clint Ober and I asked Clint to work with the engineers that were building the building because I wanted my bathroom grounded. In other words, I have this bathroom on a first floor, right? And the first floor is over the parking garage. But instead of putting rubber or, you know, sound preventing material between the concrete and my marble floor, my bathroom floor is marble, not tile, but the certain tiles that will conduct, but rock, you know, will really conduct. So it's marble on concrete without a liner, you know, so, you know, I might get a little noise in the bathroom. But the amazing thing is, the amazing thing in my mind is, when I get up in the middle of the night, you know, I'm an aging male to urinate, or I take a shower in my bathroom, or when I brush my teeth and I'm on barefoot on the floor, all that, I know in my mind I'm grounded. And it doesn't take long to reset the autonomic nervous system.
Right.
It happens instantaneously. So I'll tell you, I really think, and I'm not really thinking out of the box, because this is happening in Germany right now. I really think in the next 10 or 20 years, you're going to be seeing builders in America who are going to be building, you know, houses or apartments that have grounded rooms in them. Because I think the science is just too pervasive. Now it is, but it's going to be dogma in the next 10 or 20 years. Remember this, Dr. Z. I mean, you're a smart guy. You know this. Like when CoQ10 came around, it took 50 years. You know, it was discovered by Merck Pharmaceuticals back in 1972, but it took 50 years to really get it to where it, you know, is now, you know, as in mainstream medicine. So the same thing is going to be true with earthing and grounding. I mean, it does everything good for the body. It's just amazing. And I'll tell you, the best research I ever did on it was when we determined that grounding thins the blood. When we did that research, and we showed that 2 hours of grounding thinned the blood 283%. Think about that. Now, look, Dr. Z, why are people getting all these heart attacks today at early ages and strokes?
Well, they have ketchup blood, or they have
ketchup blood. Yeah, that's right. Instead of red wine blood. Yeah. When blood sticks in the brain, you get a stroke. When it sticks in the heart, you get a heart attack. And, right. And basically, you know, you want, you know, red wine blood. And grounding is one thing that thins the blood. You know, when I did that research, and I realized that grounding could be the greatest thing in preventing strokes and heart attacks, I thought this was the greatest research I ever did. In fact, when I submitted it to the medical journals, I thought they were going to eat this up. And I got rejection after rejection after rejection. And you got to look, Dr. Z, I'm a reviewer for journals. I review other people's work to say, oh, it's bad research or it's good research, et cetera, et cetera. So I thought this was Nobel Prize material. I thought this was the greatest stuff I ever stumbled upon. And nobody wanted to publish it because they thought it was too crazy, too woo-woo, despite the fact that we had real science. But then Alternative Medicine and Reviews published it, which was good. So, you know, I mean, I really think that, you know, with there's about 25 papers out on grounding. When another 25 more come out, you know, the real scientists, the bench scientists are going to say, hey, wait a minute. You know, we got to get involved with this. And, you know, it's going to take another 10 or 20 years, but you'll probably still be around. And you'd always say to your clients or to your radio personnel, oh, I interviewed Dr. Sinatra on that. And he told me it was going to take another 10 or 20 years.
Well, so basically going barefoot and connecting with the earth in some way is all you need to get this energy. It's not high tech. It's not, you don't have to buy anything. I mean, it sounds, you know, it's like almost too good to be true. It's like something free. Hey, there's always a catch, right?
There's always a catch. No, there's no catch with ground. The only catch with grounding, I will say this, is that if you're on potent blood thinners like Coumadin, uh-huh, or some of the other, even the, like some of the, like the Zetias, the newer blood thinners, so to speak. If you're on these blood thinners, you'd have to work with your doctor if you're going to do a lot of, if you're going to sleep grounded, for example, or walk barefoot for hours and hours, because what we found, and, you know, it happened all by accident, but even my patients who were taking Coumadin, who was sleeping grounded, this is like over, you know, a decade ago. You know, their protons were coming back very high, and we had to adjust, you know, their Coumadin. So it's important that if you do take potent blood thinners, we didn't see it with baby aspirin. We didn't see it, but we saw it with the Coumadin-like derivatives. You have to be cautious and work with your doctor, because you don't want to make your blood too thin. You know, in other words, where you're urinating, you know, a straw color, so to speak, or eating.
So that means it seems to have something to do with the whole maybe vitamin K and fibrinogen pathway. You know, sometimes I run that if I find that people have too thick blood. Because Dr. Sinatra, you can have thick blood from a lot of things. You can have I call it maple syrup blood. It's almost right. It's almost maple syrup time in Connecticut. So I usually go out there and tap my trees. You know, that's what we do in the Northeast when it's so cold. We can't go to the beach. Well, I guess we can, but kind of cold. So you can have maple syrup blood, or you can have ketchup blood if you have too much fibrin. Sometimes the fat can be in your blood to thicken it. Some people, they're just chronically dehydrated. That thickens blood. So there's a lot of mechanisms of how the blood can become very thick. and not good and prone to strokes.
Even high blood sugar.
Oh yeah, and the sugar too, yeah. But what is the grounding that sort of works with resetting which of those mechanisms, the vitamin K mechanism or the fibrin mechanism or the antioxidant mechanism? Do they
what
know?
What it does basically is it has to do with the repulsion of red blood cells. In other words, what earthing does, it makes red blood cells, instead of stick together, they repel one another.
Oh.
It's like two magnets
opposite magnets, right?
So if you take, let's say, blood from a person who's next to a computer or talking on a cordless phone, and you put it under a dark field, you'll see clumps. In other words, we call that rouleau formation. We'll see blood cells like stacked up like poker chips. They'll be like, you know, like little mini clots. But if you take somebody who's been earthing, what you'll see is those red blood cells, in other words, they repel one another. And that's why the blood is, you know, like 283% thinner. And that's what you want. You want thinner blood. So it's the repulsion of the activity of the red blood cells that is really key right here. You know, another thing when you know, walking on the beach, I don't know if I ever mentioned this on one of your previous programs, did I ever mention the impact of an outgoing tide?
No.
You're a natural path, so you'll resonate with this. But I was on I was fly fishing in the Bahamas. This is about 7 or 8 years ago. And I went into this little primitive restaurant. They had a bar there and a TV. And this is amazing. I had a full beard and I had my fly rod with me. And I just wanted to get a Coke or a ginger ale or water or something, because I felt I was dehydrated. So the Dr. Oz show was on, and there I was. In other words, they were running a rerun, and all of a sudden the bartender looks at me and people turn around and she goes like this. She points to the TV and she says, "Is that you?" And I said, "Yeah, it was me." So she knew I was a doctor and everything else. And she happened to be a Bush Indian woman. This is amazing. She was like, from generations down, she was handed this medical knowledge. She taught me this, Dr. Z. This is amazing. She said to me that basically when you walk barefoot, she was privy to this. She knew about what walking barefoot was. But what I didn't know was that when you walk barefoot on an outgoing tide, think about this. You're walking in the ocean, right? And you're walking in maybe 6 inches of water. But the tide is going out. In other words, you can feel that rush against your feet, right? What this woman taught me was one of the best ways of detoxing the body energetically was dig your feet in and let the outgoing tide pull out toxins via the lymphatic system. Think about that. Where gravity brings down through the lymph, you know, everything, you know, into our ankles and our, you know, lower feet and everything. We have many acupuncture points there. And when the outgoing tide energetically pulls, you know, some of these constituents out, this is amazing stuff.
Yeah.
And she was telling me how she healed people or detoxed people. You know, they would spend 6 hours, you know, in an outgoing tide. People with, you know, inflammatory arthritis and all these medical conditions she was telling me about, how she was getting people detoxed on an outgoing tide. So the benefit of earthing and grounding, you're thinning the blood. And now you're detoxing the person at the same time. I mean, I thought that was incredible stuff energetically, because, you know, as a naturopath, you know more about energetic medicine than any, you know, conventional physician. So to you, it's probably music to your ears when you hear something like that.
Yeah, it's amazing. Wow. And then we have a few more minutes in the show. What about, you mentioned being isolated and that effect on the heart. You want to talk a little bit about that. You think that that's isolation is very damaging for the cardiac system?
Oh my gosh, yeah. I mean, now I'm speaking like a psychotherapist, but even this pandemic where, you know, we've had lockdowns and stuff like that, I mean, the suicide rate has gone astronomically up, not only in adults, but children as well. I mean, you know, whenever you have panic or despair or depression or severe anxiety from lockdowns where you can't go outside or you know you feel trapped, the energy of feeling trapped. This has undesirable effects on not only the autonomic nervous system, but the central nervous system as well. So now you're like you're driving your car with your brakes on. And unfortunately, a lot of people, have had emotional despair and emotional panic. And this could lead to, undesirable events. And again, unfortunately, we've even seen suicide, which is really a disaster in the young person. So what we need to do is we need to connect with one another. We need to, be with one another. If you're an adult and let's say you're an older person and you've lost vital connections in your life through death or illness or whatever it is, you need to establish new vital connections. And that's the power of pets. And I know we're running out of time, but I used to even tell my patients that lost people, in their 70s or 80s and their kids were in different parts of the universe and they couldn't see their children. Mm-hmm. They were depressed, Dr. Z. They were home alone. And I used to tell them, go find a pet, make a connection with a pet, because a pet will always give you unconditional love. And loneliness is the greatest sin. We got to realize that. That's the greatest sin, intense loneliness. So sometimes if you can't get it from our fellow humans, you can get it from pets. And that's why pets who give us unconditional love, we can thrive in that unconditional love.
We just lost our dog and cat last year.
Oh,
so
no.
A tough year.
That's a heartbreak. That's a heartbreak.
So we're going through that now. We have our parrot, our 20-year-old parrot. She keeps us laughing and entertained.
I'm glad you have pets. That's so good.
Yeah, we're thinking about getting another pet soon. Kind of hard. But so this has been a great discussion, Dr. Sinatra. I appreciate it so much. We've kind of touched on so many things from peer-reviewed research to looking at nutrition to looking at, the kind of the mind, body, spirit to energy medicine. Boy, I tell you, and I guess that's what the ancients called the chakras. It was like an energetic center, which actually correspond to the physical organ. Can you leave us with some parting thoughts in the last minute or so?
Well, whenever you can open up your chakras, I mean, this is amazing. And one of the chakras that's closed on a lot of us is our third eye. The chakra, that's right below the pineal gland in that area of the body. And again, opening up the third eye is, it can be an arduous task for many of us. But I'll tell you, again, not to be redundant, earthing and grounding can be a source of opening up, the chakras in the body, even whether it's, the sexual chakra all the way up and opening up the heart chakra. The most important thing about opening up, the heart chakra is letting down into your emotions, having willingness to have your emotions out, particularly sadness. So crying will alleviate the heartbreak that can lead to heart disease, and crying will alleviate tension in the fourth chakra of the heart. So I want to leave our listeners with that. The more you cry, the better it is for you, because you'll free up the energy of the fourth chakra, and that's the energy of the heart.
Wow. That's really interesting. Thank you so much. Okay. Well, you have a wonderful day, and we're going to ground up here in the north, whether it's cold or not. And we look forward to having you on again.
All right, Dr. Z. God bless. It was a lot of fun. Thanks so much. All right, bye-bye.
And that does it for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. We always wish you to stay healthy and enjoy the vitality and best of health. Bye-bye.